Good evening, and happy feast day of St. Patrick. I'm not actually Irish myself, though I remember I'm delighted that the Irish celebrate this great Brit. I remember when I first went to Latin America, and my Spanish was very poor, and I was welcomed by a bishop who was in Ecuador, and he went, obviously thought that I was Irish, because he went on and on about how wonderful the Irish were and how awful the English were. My assistant for that trip was an Irishman from Dublin called Flannan, who enjoyed it all immensely. And then when he finished, somebody whispered in his ear and he blushed bright red. And I stood up and I made the first speech I ever made in Spanish. And I began by saying, "El obispo está embarazado," which I thought meant the bishop is embarrassed. Unfortunately, it actually meant the bishop is pregnant. Which he wasn't. But I read, coming here on the tube, I read an article by Melanie McDonough, and she said, today, we're all Irish. The Taj Mahal, the Leaning Tower of Pisa, the Sydney Opera House, they're all green today. So it's a feast for us all. A free and tolerant Catholic might sound like a contradiction in terms. It's widely assumed that Catholics are not allowed to think for themselves. The church has done all the thinking for you. Dogma gives us all the answers. And the 17th century Enlightenment thought that what liberated people was the rejection of Catholic dogma. At last, people are free to think for themselves. This view is an essential part for many people, of their English identity. You might say it is the great dogma of the English. Now, Winston Churchill was hardly a convinced Christian. He believed that he should support the church like a flying buttress from the outside. He even played with the idea of becoming a Muslim. But Winston Churchill was British in this, that he thought that Catholicism was a thoroughly bad thing. Un-English. It's the submission to a foreign tyrant. And it's true that sometimes the church has been intolerant, unthinking. That's true of every institution, including the one from which I've just arrived this evening, Oxford University. But at least it's not as bad as the one that Greg comes from, which is Cambridge University. But I want to suggest that, properly understood, dogma is the very opposite of dogmatic in the modern pejorative sense. Because what dogma does is it invites us to engage with a mystery which is always beyond our grasp. It offers us truths, but truths we cannot master. These truths, the truths of dogma, they don't wrap things up. They provoke us to pray, to think, to struggle. And they will do until the end of time, when we see God face to face. I will also argue that it's true that the church has been often intolerant, but actually it challenges our society, which is more profoundly intolerant itself. So dogma. Strictly speaking, dogma is just a part of what the church teaches. But it's the heart, it's the inalienable core of church teaching. Dogma are the truths which we have defined as a part of our faith. Many of them are found in the creed, and they can never be revoked. The church could never, for example, say, oh, well, Jesus, after all, wasn't the Son of God, you know, he was just a jolly decent chap. The church could never deny that Jesus rose from the dead. That would be to dynamite the rock upon which we're built. But I have to tell you something rather scandalous. There were three archaeologists digging in the Middle East, all members of religious orders. There was a Dominican, a Franciscan, and a Jesuit. And they came across a tomb of a first century man, and he'd been crucified. They were getting a bit panicky at this stage. And then inside the tomb, they found a bit of wood, and it said, Jesus Christ, King of the Jews. And the Dominican wept. He said, oh, the truths on which my faith are built, they're undermined. And the Franciscan was terribly disturbed. He said, the joy of St. Francis was for nothing. But the Jesuit smiled to himself, and he said, oh, so he did exist after all. G.K. Chesterton said that all human beings are dogmatic. He wrote, there are only two kinds of people, those who accept dogmas and know it, and those who accept dogmas and don't. Trees have no dogmas. Turnips are singularly broad-minded. We know our dogmas, more or less, and we believe that they are beautiful and liberating, precisely because they don't wrap up the truth. They propose a truth which is forever beyond our tight grasp, and which we will always go on seeking to understand and always failing. I remained a Dominican when I joined, as Greg rather tactlessly said, a very long time ago. I remained a Dominican in those very tough years, the late 60s, the early 70s, when everybody was leaving. There was the famous sign on the board, last out, turn out the lights. Everything seemed to be coming apart. We had a massive loss of confidence. But one of the reasons that I and many of my brethren stayed was because great preachers like Herbert McCabe, Fergus Carr, showed us the beauty of doctrine, the beauty of our teaching. And I don't think that the church will be able to survive unless we recover a sense that we have a beautiful teaching. Spirituality is wonderful, but isolated from teaching, it's not enough. You know, light a candle and find where you are on the Enneagram. Our teaching gives us truths that set us free. Take the Council of Chalcedon, for example. That's in the 5th century, and it gave us the beautiful dogma of the humanity and divinity of Christ. This didn't mean that we could now say, oh, we got that sorted. We know who Jesus is. Next question. Quite the contrary. Prior to the council, there were some theologians, particularly around a place called Antioch, who celebrated the humanity of Christ, For them, we couldn't have been saved if he wasn't human. But they were a bit weak when it came to the divinity. How could he be divine if he was human? And there were other theologians, particularly around Alexandria in Egypt, for whom it was fundamental that he was divine. If he wasn't divine, we weren't saved. But they struggled to make any sense of his humanity. Well, what happened at the Council of Chalcedon? Very briefly, and I won't look at Greg here, because he might be frowning at me for his oversimplification. What happened at the Council of Chalcedon is that we were pushed beyond two small ways of understanding things. Heresy is basically what's narrow, limited. Either alone were too small. They pushed us to a truth that we couldn't explain. Generation after generation of theologians struggle to make sense of how Jesus is both human and divine. And forever we've gone thinking, praying, trying to peek into the mystery, a truth that we're given, but we never master. It's like climbing a mountain. You keep thinking you can see the summit, and when you get there, it isn't. There's another summit beyond. So as Gregory of Nyssa said in the 4th century, we go from beginning to beginning to beginning. And it's the same with another great doctrine of the Church, which is the Trinity. You know, it looks like celestial mathematics. How many angels can you have dancing on a pinhead? But it's not a mathematical statement. It's not as if you're asking how many planets revolve around the sun. In heaven, we won't be able to say, oh, well, there's the Father. Somewhere there's the Son. Yes, over there. Where's the Holy Spirit? Spot the pigeon, as art historians say. A true story, which I was told a week ago in Seattle. One of our brethren, a Vietnamese Dominican in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, was celebrating Pentecost. And he had this bright idea that at a certain moment in the sermon, he would make a sign and a white dove would be released. Anyway, he made the sign and nothing happened. And a voice was heard shouting from the roof, "Father, Father, the cat has eaten the Holy Spirit." You see, again, the dogma of the Trinity doesn't wrap it all up. It's not speculating about some, you know, three people living in a remote place, three aliens on Pluto. It pushes one to the mystery of a love in which we live. A love which is utterly undominative, without manipulation, utterly equal. The truth of the Trinity is the most practical, down-to-earth truth there is. We live it, or struggle to live it, every day. When parents try to love their children in a way that lets them grow up into equality. When we love our friends in a way that refuses domination or manipulation. It challenges us all, every day, to live a little bit of that mystery. St. Augustine said, "Show me a lover, and he will understand what I'm saying." You could put it the other way around. Show me a lover, and I will try to understand what they're saying. So we need the help of everyone who's ever tried to understand what it means to love, regardless of whether they're Christian or not. We need the help of novelists, filmmakers, poets, everyone who explores the complexity, the delicacy of loving. We are the disciples of them all, because it's a truth that we go on seeking to glimpse, but we can never possess it. What about tolerance? Doesn't religious belief make us terribly intolerant? All over the world, you can see people being slaughtered because of doctrinal differences. Until recently, of course, in Ireland, Christians and Protestants. In Baghdad, I've just been recently to Baghdad, as Greg said, Shia and Sunni Muslims, Buddhists and Hindus. Everywhere you see conflict fueled by religious hatred. But this is not because religious people are somehow bigoted and intolerant. It's because of a particularly modern temptation, which is towards fundamentalism. And you find many forms of fundamentalism. Most prominently, and probably the origin, scientific fundamentalism. The belief that the mystery of human consciousness can be reduced to electrical currents in the brain, or that love is no more than passing on the propagation of our genes. There are economic fundamentalists who believe that everything can be reduced to the mere working of the market, the invisible hand of the market. And there are religious fundamentalists. But I think you can argue that historically, religious fundamentalism was a reaction to the rise of earlier forms of fundamentalism, specifically scientific. And dogma is the antibody to the virus of fundamentalism. It invites us to humility in the face of the mystery. St. Thomas Aquinas famously said, "In this life, we are joined to God as to the unknown." And my brother Greg will know, remember, the first lesson that you ever learn in theology. He's looking slightly puzzled, but I'm not going to ask him. God is not a terribly powerful and important person. Last December, I had the wonderful privilege of attending a conference in Rome, a mini summit for Muslim and Christian leaders. And we were in a wonderful variety. There was a Sunni prince from Jordan. There were Sufi ayatollahs, Anglican and Muslim, Anglican and Episcopalian bishops, bags of Catholic cardinals. And what we shared was not the lowest common denominator. What we tried to share was the glimpse of the ineffable mystery. There was a Jordanian scholar who quoted a wonderful text from 800 years before the birth of Christ. "O God who I know and do not know. O God who I know and do not know. If we didn't know anything of our God, we would have nothing to say. But if we knew it all, we'd have nothing to learn." So the great seeker after the truth is humble. Humble of heart and mind. It was said of St. Dominic that he understood everything through the humility of his the humble intelligence of his heart. It's only those who St. Teresa of Avila calls the medio letrados, the half-learned, who think they're superior to everybody else. One of my fellow novices, Simon Tugwell, wrote, "These are the people who know enough to think that they know everything, but not enough to know that they know almost nothing." The person who searches for the truth, whether academic or not, he says, is precisely the babe, the person who knows that he or she is at the beginning, not at the end of the road. And so, Catholic dogma invites us to humility before the mystery. One of my great privileges was to live for a year in Saint-Jacques in Paris with a Dominican called Marie-Dominique Chenu, who's often called the father of the Second Vatican Council. And every night, even when he was way up in his late 70s, 80, he'd go out, he'd go to meetings of academics and trade unionists and students and artists, and we'd meet him in the evening and have a beer at about 11 o'clock. And he'd always say, "What have you learnt today?" "This is what I learnt today." So I think we can talk about an intellectual humility. But what about a more general tolerance of each other? One of the triumphs of modernity is a profound desire to get beyond the intolerances of the past. When I was growing up as a child, British society was extraordinarily intolerant. It was racially intolerant, filled with class prejudice, male superiority, anti-Semitism, the rejection of gay people. I grew up in a fantastic family, but even so, there was a profound intolerance of those ghastly people who are socialists. It was the worst thing you could ever say of anybody. "Do you know, that awful chap is a socialist." Now today, I think for most young people, these intolerances have become incomprehensible. In theory, anyway. And I think we have to accept this offers a challenge to the church. We've often colluded and been at the source of anti-Semitism in the most terrible way, has often been a dire prejudice in the church against gay people. So Pope Francis has called upon the church to become, I quote, "the house of the Father, with the doors always wide open, where there's a place for everyone with all their problems, and to move towards those who feel the need to take up again their path of faith." I think that's the task of the two synods, the one we had last year and the one that we're holding again this October, is to help the church to understand how at the same time to propose a moral vision and yet be a home for everybody. But the church needs to challenge the dominant understanding of tolerance. Because what it usually means is that we're free to believe whatever we want because our beliefs are essentially unimportant. Gay or straight, male, female, Christian or Buddhist, English or French, what does it matter? We're all the same. And so why shouldn't gay people marry each other? Why care about differences of religion? Deep down, there's no difference. Now, this looks like radical tolerance. It may even evoke those words of St. Paul in his letter to the Galatians, that in Christ there's neither Jew nor Gentile, slave nor free, male nor female, but authentic difference, sorry, authentic tolerance rejoices in difference, is enriched by it. The word tolerance comes from a Latin word which means to bear things, to bear the weight of difference, to bear the pain of difference sometimes, to bear it fruitfully. Richard Sennett has argued in his latest book that Western society is afraid of difference. He said, because of growing inequality in a fluid society in which people move rapidly from one place to another, we have lost the art of living with people who are unlike us. We're afraid of difference. Zygmunt Bauman of Warsaw University in Leeds has written how the mobility of modern society encourages the impulse to withdraw from risk-ridden complexity into the shelter of uniformity. And the internet reinforces this tendency. On Facebook, you indicate your choices, your likes, your dislikes, you know, and then you give the thumb up, give a nice emoji to people you agree with. And if you disagree, you disconnect. So you're spared the friction of living with difference. So you can join a community which is global, takes in Chile and China, but you might not have to face the pain, the difficulty, the struggle of understanding your next door neighbour. Although he was the best one I ever had. The tolerance of modernity is actually extremely intolerant of any real difference. Religion is okay as long as it's private, or maybe it can be folkloric. So it's lovely if the Jews celebrate Hanukkah and if the Muslims celebrate Eid. Perhaps a bit less acceptable that we Christians celebrate Christmas, lest other faiths feel excluded. And so in Oxford now we have the Festival of Light. I think the tolerance of our society is profoundly intolerant of any religious belief. Now, inside the church, we can be pretty intolerant too. Often inside the church, you also find a fear of engaging with difference. Conservatives and progressive Catholics can be deeply intolerant of each other. Even Jesuits and Dominicans have been known to be a bit combative. Herbert McCabe always liked to say, "I love the Jesuits, but I wouldn't want my daughter to marry one." But I think part of the vocation of the church is precisely to be a place where we rejoice in difference. You could argue that it is our spécialité de la maison. Look at the New Testament, embracing four different gospels, four accounts of the life of Jesus, which often contradict each other. In the second century, the timorous pushed to have one nice, neat, coherent account. But the church had the courage to resist that and to let the differences remain. The whole history of the church has been, you could say, a conversation between the four gospels. A friend of mine, Bishop Kenny, was telling me the other day that he was in a prison and he was trying to explain to the prisoners why it was that the Gospels didn't agree. And one of the prisoners said, "Of course they don't agree. Everybody knows that if all the witnesses agree, it must have been fixed. If it's the same story, it's a put-up job. Coherence, you know, is a rather infantile and petty preoccupation which can cramp our creativity. As William Carlos Williams wrote, dissonance, if you're interested, leads to discovery. I'd also want to suggest that difference is right at the heart of those two great doctrines that I mentioned, the divinity and humanity of Christ and the belief in the Trinity. I mean, just look at our belief in the divinity and the humanity of Christ. There can be no greater difference. Divinity transcends all that's created. And yet, the biggest imaginable difference that can be is embraced in this one human being. Not because there's a muddle or a mixture, but as the Council of Chalcedon said 1,500 years ago, two natures which exist without confusion, without change, without division, without separation. Or think of the doctrine of the Trinity, one God in three persons. Again, not one God with three different aspects, so, you know, they're really all the same, and not three gods who share a vague unity. Radical difference in utter unity. How does the church manage to negotiate this unity and this difference, which is at the heart of much of our doctrinal life? In part, it's because we believe in reason. You see, one of the great doctrines, one of the great dogmas of the church, defined at the First Vatican Council, is the belief in reason. If you believe in reason, then difference can be negotiated, explored, tested, and we find our way forward. We can converse. Our society is deeply dismissive of difference. When there's a disagreement, the word nonsense, absurd, comes up very, very quickly. When Elton John discovered that Dolce and Gabbana had different views about IV fertilization and gay adoption, his reaction was to burn their clothes, to lead a boycott, not to have a conversation. Now, often in the church, historically, we have failed to do that. But at our best times, and above all in the great councils of the church, we have learnt to talk and to listen. Pope Benedict made a wonderful speech at Regensburg, in which he talked about the recovery of the grandeur of reason. Not a reason which is just narrowly scientific, which is fine and valid in its own sphere, but a reasoning which is imaginatively rich, which enables us to explore the deepest questions of our existence. Pope Benedict said, the courage to engage the whole breadth of reason and not the denial of its grandeur. That's the program with which a theology grounded in biblical faith enters into the debates of our time. And so I believe we're called to be tolerant precisely as Catholics. And it's not that sort of easy pseudo-tolerance of rubbing along together and pretending we're all just the same. That's just boring. It's a much more challenging tolerance, which is humble in the face of other people and their opinions. and humble in the face of God, in whose image they're made. And when we find that we do disagree, let us hope we will have the courage sometimes to say, wonderful. At least there's a chance that we might learn something. Thank you very much.